From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Okay, all you midlifers out there, people of middle age, you ever get that stagnant feeling in your work, your marriage? It's a sense of malaise, or maybe dread, that the best part of your life is past you now. And there's a name we've taken on to describe this feeling, the midlife crisis. But the journalist Barbara Bradley Haggerty has looked at the science, and the fact is, there's almost no hard evidence for this crisis. Haggerty's written a new book that examines this middle stage of life, and she found that when you really break it down, the researchers, the psychologists, the experts, they all say this is not a time of crisis, or doesn't have to be. It's a time of renewal. Today in the program, Barbara will join us to make her case for why middle age can be not terrifying and boring, but exhilarating. Join us after the news.
KUER's volunteers give their time year-round to lend a helping hand. Our volunteers staff booths at special events, help with paperwork in our membership department, and assist the news and Radio West teams with behind-the-scenes details. Maybe you're a photographer or a graphic designer and you'd like to volunteer your skills. Or you have some spare time that you'd like to donate. We're always grateful for a little extra help from our friends. Find out more about volunteer opportunities at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. While those of us of middle age know what a midlife crisis is, there can't be many who can actually pinpoint one, like right to the moment. Barbara Bradley Haggerty can. She writes about it in her new book. It was a few days after the Memorial Day weekend. She'd been with her mother in the hospital. She'd had a stroke, and Barbara worried that what that would mean for her mother's memory and for her identity. And all of that made her think of her own circumstance at middle age. She was standing at the kitchen sink. It was springtime, her favorite time of year. And all of a sudden, she realized she felt nothing. As she puts it in her book, she felt no surge of joy at being alive, no frisson of gratitude for witnessing the rebirth of the new season. And her husband was standing next to her at the sink. She looked at him and announced, "I think I'm having a midlife crisis." But what did that mean, really, a crisis? It's what we call it, but is there more accurate way of describing this middle stage of life? That's what she does in her new book. She examines the art and science of midlife, which she says felt more like bushwhacking through a dense forest than cruising an interstate with numbered exits. She's joining us today to talk about what she found. Her book is Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. Barbara Bradley Haggerty was a correspondent for NPR for nearly 20 years. She covered law and religion. Prior to that, she was a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. She's author of the book Fingerprints of God. And she's joining us today from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. And Barbara Bradley Haggerty, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Doug.
So forgive my voice. We're going to muddle through, and I'm really sorry about this. I'm sure you can relate on some level.
I understand voice problems.
Yes, yes. We'll get into that, by the way. I wanted to actually, this was interesting. I want to begin, we spoke a few years ago with the book Fingerprints of God. This was in 2009. And I wanted to begin with some similar questions that I asked you then, actually, because I think they relate. This is pretty personal, this book too. And I wonder if you expect Fingerprints of God, it's deeply personal. Life Reimagined is deeply personal. Did you expect that at the outset? And as a journalist, did you feel again, oh no, I'm getting dragged into another book that reveals my personal life?
And all my foibles and how completely ridiculous I can be at times. You know, I have to say that Fingerprints of God felt a little harder to write from a first-person perspective. And that's because it was something that a lot of people don't quite understand or they might misunderstand, which is a sense of spirituality.
Yeah.
And that's a really personal thing. And I mean, like midlife crisis, kind of everyone knows what that means to them.
Yeah.
But spirituality is a more amorphous thing. And that one was pretty hard to write personally. In fact, this book it was much easier. In fact, I intended from the outset to write this book personally because I figured if I'm going through this stuff and I have all these deep-seated fears and this malaise and everything else, I know virtually an entire generation is going through that too. And so, and you know, one of the reasons I wrote it so personally, Doug, is because it was sheer logistics. It took me so long to do the research, like a year and some change to do the research. And I was so worried that I would have no time to write the book after finishing the research that I started writing a journal. And this actually became the framework for the book. I wrote journal entries, you know, several times a week, talking about the research and how I saw it affecting others or myself. And so by the end of the time, by the time I was ready to write the book, I actually had 500 pages of a journal, which no one would want to read. But I used that as the framework for how you kind of think about these parts of midlife. And it did become really, really personal and embarrassing at times. But it was kind of, it was fun to do it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. You end up in the emergency room a couple of times in this story.
Yeah, and not exactly, you know, some of the times it was simply because I got a really angry email from a listener and I was trying to respond to it. This was the opening of the book. And I think my heart started beating really hard, and I started feeling pain going up my back. And so I Googled, of course, what else do you do? I Googled women heart attack.
And, right in the middle of it, right? Like right,
right
in the middle,
of this, yeah, right. Yeah. Right. And so I go, oh, my goodness, I have 2 out of 3 of the symptoms of a heart attack for a woman. And then I proceeded to faint. And they found me. I was actually on the phone with my doctor when they found me. And they brought me to the hospital in an ambulance. And
let me just say that Scott Simon actually guides the paramedics to your cubicle.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Right. And John Itzty put a little sweater under
right,
my head and
right.
assured me that, you know, help was coming soon. And so I got to the hospital, and by the time I got there, I felt fine. You know, I'm great. I'm ready to go home. And the nurse kind of looked at my chart and she said, well, you're 53, right? And I said, yes. And she looked at me like 53 was a clinical condition, you know?
Right.
And in fact, you know, it's midlife. Well, you're more likely to have a heart attack or something. And so she kept me. The kind of really, really kind of tragic thing that happened that night, I couldn't get out of the – they kept me all night, and I couldn't get out of the emergency room or out of the hospital. And then around 5 o'clock, I got a call from my husband, and it turned out that my father had died while I was in the hospital. And Dad had had Alzheimer's for about 8 years, and so he wasn't the same dad I knew. He had been – that dad had gone a long time ago. But it really hit me hard that, you know, my generation was the next to go. My brother and I mean, my mom's still alive, but it hits you. Oh, my goodness. Time is not up, but time is running out.
Yeah. It seems like your father, that was offered something of a kind of a theme in some ways for this, because you write that you say Dad lived each day with verve. Mm. And that seems to be part of the theme here, this idea of engaging. Your father engaged with life.
Yeah. And so does my mom. She's 94 and she's sharp as a tack. And I watched them. I was lucky to have that kind of parenting where they just approached life with zest. And, you know, I could have probably saved a lot of time and money and a lot of travel and a lot of bothering a lot of researchers if I just observed my mom and my dad.
Right.
Because I came out with a couple of – I concluded a couple of things, and they all relate to how my parents lived. One of them was this idea of living with verve. The way I put it, which my editor wasn't – he thought it was a little negative, so we changed it. But the way I thought of it was autopilot is death.
Yeah.
That at this point, you're not going on kind of natural momentum of youth. There isn't the easy ascent of youth. You actually have to – be really intentional about how you live your life. How do you relate to your spouse? How do you relate to your children? How do you engage in your job? You need to engage intentionally and make those parts of your life that are really important to you, you have to make them front and center. And you can't let them left in the wind, because they will go away. And that's one of the big lessons, one of the tragic lessons on things like midlife divorce, that there are reasons to get divorced, but it's at record numbers. And one of the reasons is because people disengage.
Yeah. I want to break down a lot of that as we go along. Let me back up to where did we come up with this term, midlife crisis? Is this Elliot Jacques? Do we blame him?
Right. He was a Canadian psychoanalyst, and he wrote an article called Death in the Midlife Crisis in a very obscure journal in 1965. And then other researchers picked up on it, and then Gail Sheehy wrote Passages. Yeah. And, of course, it became a cultural phenomenon, right? There was no turning back after that.
Right.
So suddenly everyone has licensed to, buy the red sports car and dump your spouse. Or even if you don't have license, people thought that that was kind of a natural course of events. But about 20 years ago, researchers started to look hard at the midlife crisis, psychologists did, and they started interviewing people. And hundreds of people in depth about, did you have a midlife crisis? And what they concluded is that people were a little confused about midlife crisis.
Yeah.
A lot of people said they had a midlife crisis. But it turns out that the way Elliot Jacques defines it, and other people think of it, is this kind of existential dread of aging, and that your dreams will never be fulfilled before you breathe your last breath, right? That existential dread is very, very rare. Only about 10% of people really feel that sense of aging and dread and existential, angst. Really, what people were doing when they said they had a midlife crisis, they were saying, I lost my job when I was in my 40s, or my parents died when I was, 50, or I got a divorce when I was 48. What they were talking about was they were having a crisis at midlife,
yeah,
not a midlife crisis.
Right.
And so all of those things could happen at other times. And generally, people pull out of these external setbacks and they loop up. In fact, do you mind if I talk a little bit about the U-curve of happiness?
No. Go for it.
Okay.
I love the
U-curve. I'm saving your voice, Doug.
Yeah, thanks.
maybe there isn't a common midlife crisis, but it turns out that midlife ennui, this kind of malaise, this feeling that food doesn't taste quite as good and, colors aren't quite as vivid, that is almost universal. And there have been economists, one of them being Andrew Oswald at the University of Warwick, who has they have surveyed people in something like 75 countries. And they ask them, are you happy right now? Are you happy? Are you stressed? Whatever. What they have found is that there is a U-curve of happiness, whereby people in their 20s and 30s are very happy, but after your late 20s, you begin to slope downward, and you get a little unhappier, and then in your 40s and 50s, you hit rock bottom. And for men, it's age 50. For women in America, it's age 40. You hit rock bottom, and then you begin to swoop back up on the other side of the U, right into your 70s. And so they realized that there is something going on here, but it wasn't. But psychologists say it's not a midlife crisis. It's that people have to kind of get used to the idea that all their hopes and dreams and aspirations may not come to fruition.
Yeah.
So if you're 25, I would love to win a Pulitzer at 25, or, I would love to be CEO of the company. I would like to be the pitcher for the Red Sox, whatever it is. And as you go along, move along in life, you realize you might not get those aspirations. You have more responsibilities. Suddenly you have a mortgage, you have kids, maybe you're taking care of ailing parents, and the responsibilities begin to weigh down, as well as these kind of a little bit of crushed, dashed expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when you start going up is you revise,
yeah,
what's important to you, right? It's not, just because I'm not CEO, that doesn't mean that my life is a failure. Yeah, my kids may not be perfect, but they're really great kids. Yeah, and you begin to kind of focus on those things that are really good, your family, your friends, what's meaningful, maybe a cause or your church or something like that. And you begin to shift what you think is important, and then you get happier.
Mm. So it wasn't a crisis. It was Margie Lochman at Brandeis put it, it's a midlife checkup.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, psychologists talk about the tale of two midlifes.
Yeah.
Because we have one midlife where we are having these dashed expectations and just more responsibilities. And life isn't, you know, giddy with happiness when you're in midlife. You're not going out and, you know, dancing on the tabletops. Well, I guess I don't do that in Utah anyway. But, you know, you're not going out and partying every night. You've got responsibilities. So it's not giddy. But on the other hand, you are in your 40s and 50s. You are at the peak of your career in terms of income, or many people are, I should say, at the peak of your career in terms of income and stature. And you've got a lot more wisdom and you just feel more confident about life. So there are really kind of two midlifes going on. And so often we emphasize the bad midlife when we should think about the good midlife.
Why do you think that is? Do you think we've been stuck with this? It's almost like it's a popular cultural impression of midlife crisis, that everyone has it because it's been in a couple of movies. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's what's happened. I think there's a cultural, you know, Lester Burnham in American Beauty. It's a popular myth combined with the sense that I think there is something really very real going on with people in their middle years. It is not they are in sometimes kind of burdened years. You often see things, I mean, so there may be real angst going on for some people. You know, maybe they're not progressing as fast as they like in their jobs. Maybe they're seeing some of the opportunities go to the younger people who are more tech savvy, that kind of thing. Maybe they feel like they're a little bit trapped, because they have a mortgage and their kids are going to college and all of that, and they can't afford to change and follow their muse or whatever. And so I think there is something really legitimate going on with how we think about midlife, but it's not, it shouldn't be licensed for bad behavior, you know? It's not existential generally. It's more temporary.
I want to, before we head into a break, I want to identify these three themes, and then we can break them down as we go. But I want to go through these, that these are the themes that you sort of distilled down from the things you were learning. I think we talked about this first one. Maybe we should say just a bit more. Engage with verve, or as you put it, autopilot is death. That's the first theme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because I think that how you approach this kind of relates to another one as well, but how you approach your marriage. I mean, let me take the example of marriage. One of the secrets about the unhappy secrets about midlife divorce, which is quite common, is that it's very different from early divorce. So if you're divorcing after, say, 14 years as opposed to 7 years. The reason you divorce is because you have disengaged. You're not invested in each other anymore. There may be some hostility. You're thinking in terms of I and not us. And what you need to do, not in every marriage, obviously, some marriages should end, but what you should try to think to do before throwing in the towel is to actually engage. How do I make this person feel safe? How do I make them feel that I am on their team, that I've got their back? You've got to engage in that marriage, in that relationship for it to flourish. Otherwise, it's going to wither and die. And you see that with other things, career. Mm-hmm. If you don't engage in your career, if you're just phoning it in, it's not going to work out very well. You won't be happy. And so that is a major point, is just you have to engage.
You mentioned happiness. That's another of these themes. Choose purpose over happiness.
Right. Right. You know, one of the really cool things is there's kind of a Cinderella trait right now, and it is called purpose in life or purpose. Psychologists are now looking at people who have purpose in life, that they have a reason to get out of bed in the morning. It may be their children. It may be they love their work. It may be they're involved with church. It may be that they want to be they're a competitive cyclist, so they want to do that long ride. Whatever it is, they have a reason to get up in the morning. And if they choose kind of this long-term goal, these long-term goals of purpose, it may not be satisfying in the moment. Like, it is hard to ride 50 miles, or it may be hard to stay up all night when your child is sick, right? But the long-term benefit of raising good kids, or, you know, riding in that race that makes you healthy, the long-term benefits are really, really powerful versus happiness, which is, you know, hedonia, mm-hmm. this idea of having, a fine wine and a great meal. Now, that's all great, but biologically and psychologically, it doesn't help you nearly as much as having these long-term purposeful goals. It's one of the major things that you can do for your health, your memory, for everything is to have purpose, long-term purpose and meaning rather than short-term happiness.
We'll come back to that one. And then finally, this theme, your thinking is your experience. Say something about that.
This one comes right from my mother.
Yeah,
She used to say this to me all the time. You and I have talked about this, I think. I was raised a Christian Scientist, and they put their money where their mouth is. They believe that prayer heals, that your thinking really, really matters. And I kind of marinated in that for many years until I left the religion, but I still think it's an important idea. How you think really can shape how you experience the world. It's how you experience your marriage, your career, even setbacks. It's not going to wipe out the cancer diagnosis, but it will affect, and actually studies show it will affect how well you recover, how fast you recover. So your thinking really shades your whole world. Is it going to be, and I'm not saying whistle a happy tune, we all have problems, but how do you approach those problems? Is it with a sense of despair and doom, or is it with a sense of, gosh, okay, let's look at this. How can we approach this positively? How can we approach our fight I had with my husband positively? That kind of thing. And that really, really, really affects how you live out midlife.
There's such an interesting spin on this. I don't want to talk about it right now, but with your brother and this prayer you had with him. So don't let me forget that before this conversation is over, because it's a really fascinating part of the story. Barbara Bradley Haggerty is with us. Her book is Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we have with us former NPR reporter Barbara Bradley Haggerty. She's joining us to offer some encouragement and some hope and some science to those of us who think middle age is a crisis. She's written a book that examines this middle stage of life. It was something personal that got her started. She's in that stage right now herself, and so she traveled all around the country talking to brain scientists and psychologists and all kinds of middle agers. Her book is Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. She's joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. I think the thing that gives most of us middle-agers the most anxiety is our memory. Let's talk about that. How's your memory these days? Because you write in the book, you have the same kind of anxiety we all do.
Who are you again?
Yeah.
What am I doing here?
Right.
My memory is... I'm like everyone else at this stage of life, or maybe not like everyone else, but here's what my memory's like. I left the car running for about 8 hours while I was at NPR one day. Right. I just forgot to bring the keys with me, and so I had no gas. I forget where I leave my keys. I forget colleagues' names. But, so I got to tell you, Doug, I was a little bit... I was really kind of terrified about what was happening to my memory, especially since my dad got dementia. Mom is great, but dad got dementia. I was so cheered by the science of the midlife brain. I cannot tell you. It's like the best. It was the best news I had, practically. And what scientists are finding is that really midlife, the 50s, late 40s, 50s, is kind of the sweet spot of... for your brain. And that's because there are essentially two types of intelligence, and one of them goes downhill after 30 and the other keeps going right into your 70s. Fluid intelligence is, can you solve novel problems? I mean, think about Sherlock Holmes. You think of it kind of as this raw intelligence, raw IQ. That starts decreasing after around age 30.
Yeah.
And your processing speed does. And, you know, some stuff is happening with your brain. It's actually shrinking. And so that's why you can't, you're not quite as quick. Maybe you don't remember the telephone number that someone just gave you, that kind of thing. But there's another type of intelligence called crystallized intelligence.
Yeah.
And that's all the stuff we scoop up during our lifetime. It's vocabulary. It's expertise. It's you knowing how to conduct a radio interview. It's me knowing how to write a piece. It's you know, learning a foreign language. It's all this stuff. It's reading the New York Times, going to museums. Whatever it is, we are constantly scooping up more and more information. And that increases crystallized intelligence. And what happens in midlife is that we haven't lost that much fluid intelligence, but we have really gained a lot of crystallized intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a really wonderful time it's a wonderful time. Okay, so if you are going into surgery, which would you rather have? The 30-year-old surgeon who's really quick and smart, or the 50-year-old surgeon who may not be quite as quick but is also smart? You want the 50-year-old. Why? He's seen this before.
Right.
He's done hundreds more surgeries, or thousands more. So that's what you get. You get this expertise and this sureness and this wisdom that can only come with time.
Two things were really interesting about this section. One of them was the fact that that you could actually increase your IQ at this age. Because I think we have this idea that, okay, your IQ is something that we settle on really early in our lives.
Right.
There's still some dispute about all of this. You point this out. But, I mean, would you say something about that? Because this is really interesting.
Yeah. So an IQ has to do with both fluid and crystallized intelligence. So in one way, you can increase it just through living. On the other hand, you know, I did an experiment that was rather terrifying, because I just hate standardized tests. I've always been bad at taking them. But I decided what I was going to do is I was going to work with these two researchers who were then at the University of Maryland, who have essentially increased IQ, or it looks like they have. And what I did is I took a bunch of standardized tests one day. They were torture. They were horrible. They were torture. I actually recorded myself taking them. And then I did brain training for a month, which was about 20 minutes a day on this little computerized game called the NBAC. That was also torture. I dreaded that every single day. So I did that, and then I went back and I retook the tests. And what I found is that while I was taking the tests the second time, and they're not the exact same tests, but I was a little bit familiar with them. But while I was taking them, it was as if, Doug, time slowed down. It was as if I had more time to do the problems. And on all of the overall, I improved my tests by 18%. But in the kind of gold standard test called the Ravens test, which is a gold standard of fluent intelligence, I mean, I guess I was really dumb before, because I increased it by 75%. They were gobsmacked. And now, you know, maybe I felt badly the first day and was really sharp the second time, or, you know, there's the test retest effect and all of that. But they thought this was too big an improvement for placebo. The takeaway, though, is not that you should do brain training, because I wouldn't ask anyone to do that. For me, it was absolute torture. The takeaway is that the more you do things that are novel and interesting and challenging.
Yeah.
For example, take up Spanish or learn the piano, or if you played piano before, just take it up as a hobby again, or go to museums, that kind of thing. The more you challenge your brain, the more you, in fact, can increase or stave off any decline in this fluid intelligence, and thus kind of effectively increase your intelligence. So it is really, really good news. As long as you keep challenging your brain, you're going to do – I mean, you can say this about everyone. I always have to throw this caveat. If someone gets Alzheimer's disease, it's going to be really difficult. But, you know, if you there are things you can do to keep your brain sharp,
but all other things notwithstanding. But even in the case of Alzheimer's, and this was an interesting story, there's a group of researchers who are, as opposed to dealing with the negative sort of symptoms of Alzheimer's, they're dealing with it in a sort of more proactive, positive
yes.
way. Talk about that, because that was
this
the
is
other part.
Such, really this is such a cool study, and it's been going on for about 20 years ago. So at Chicago's Rush University Medical Center, they have a unit that has been studying people for about 20 years or so. And what they do is they begin by giving cognitive and psychological tests for people who agree, people who are in retirement homes. Now, they all start healthy. So it's not like, you know, everyone is healthy when they begin. And then they do these tests, cognitive and psychological tests, every single year until the person dies. And then they do an autopsy of their brain.
Yeah.
Now, here's what's fascinating. Fully a third of the people who had Alzheimer's, their brains showed upon autopsy, didn't show any symptoms of dementia. They didn't show any memory loss or personality change or confusion. They were sharp right to the end. And so they said, my gosh, you know, how do we explain that? And fortunately for them and for us, they had the data to look back and say, okay, what were the things that seemed to predict escaping? These people are called escapees.
Yeah.
Right. What are the things that predict escaping the symptoms of Alzheimer's? And they could do all of these, you know, statistical analyses and all of these things. And some things are predictable, right? Do you have a social network? Do you stay intellectually engaged? Do you keep relatively in shape, you know, physically fit, that kind of thing? But there was one psychological trait that seemed to predict more than any others. Who would escape the symptoms of Alzheimer's? And we've discussed it already. It's purpose in life.
Yeah.
People who had a purpose in life, who had grandkids they wanted to see, who were, you know, part of their community and there was something that they were working on, a legislation they were trying to pass. People who loved to read and would get a box of books from the library every week. These people who had purpose in life, they were far more likely to escape the symptoms of Alzheimer's than someone who didn't really have a reason to get up in the morning.
You know, there was a large collection of nuns in a study that, and I wondered if that related, this gets us to the kind of spiritual component of all of this.
Yeah.
Is there a sort of religious spiritual component when you're talking about living life purposefully? Does God provide that purpose in
that case? I mean, that is so interesting. I mean, I think for people who are religious, who do feel that there is a God, I think it is a major purpose. I know, you know, I'm serious about my faith.
Yeah.
And it is that belief, not only a belief in God, but it's also a belief that what I do now matters. Living purposefully and well now matters actually for eternity. Mm-hmm. I know that'll sound crazy to some people, but that what we do counts, that keeps me in line and it gives me a sense that, you know, I need to do this. I want to do this. It counts. It matters that I help other people. It matters that I engage in my marriage because for me, there's a spiritual component to it. And you know, you're right about the nuns. The nuns were the first who showed that there were a whole bunch of nuns who, upon autopsy, had really bad Alzheimer's. I mean, high levels of Alzheimer's that didn't show any symptoms. And those, they had obviously a spiritual component. They also were educators, and so they had a reason to kind of get up in the morning and pour themselves into these children that they were educating. So there was that as well. There was both a human and a spiritual component.
Let's talk about the section you wrote on friendship, which I love this. You describe as being like a smoke detector. We need them, but they can be a nuisance to keep them up. And it's explain this. You write, if we want to live a long and healthy life, invest in friends, particularly in midlife. Now, Barbara, explain why.
Well, midlife is when we discard friends. We're so busy with our career, with taking care of family, whether up a generation or down a generation, with making ends meet, doing all these responsibilities. The first thing to be cut from our lives are our friends. And the reason that's a problem, studies are beginning to show, is that friends can actually be more important than family in keeping you healthy and keeping you mentally kind of cognitively robust until your late years. The reason is really interesting. It's almost biological. There's a biological component. What friends do is they share the burden of life. Now, family does this too, but you can have enough friends that there are various people that you can share the burden of, say, you know, I have Jody who understands the news business, and I can talk to her endlessly about the issues of deadlines. Or I have, you know, another friend who goes to my church, and I can talk to her about spiritual things. What they do is they you can offload some of the stressors of life to friends, and you feel that they have your back. Mm. And biologically, what that does is it actually kind of reduces, it boosts your immune system, it reduces the stress hormones, it actually helps you live longer. You're less likely to have, you know, a stroke or heart attack. You're more likely to keep your memory intact if you have friends. It's a biological thing. And the reason it's biological is because it's actually dangerous at the periphery. When you look at who gets eaten in mm-hmm. when, you know, the lion is chasing the herd of gazelle, and it's the one on the outside. It's not because the one on the outside is the slowest. It's because he's the easiest to catch. Well, we have kind of incorporated that into our bodies, and we know, our bodies know, that isolation is dangerous. You should not be isolated. And so what loneliness is a signal. Hey, you know what? You're in dangerous territory here. You need to get back into the safe center of the herd. That's what loneliness does for you, because our bodies know that biologically it's dangerous for us to be lonely.
I love this idea that our brains are wired to make us dependent. And I think a lot of people, we think of our lives as being individual, but when we're healthy, when we're engaged, we're with someone, we're with people, we're more...
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And because of that, we can in some ways relax. One really wonderful kind of, we can't know because we didn't live 10,000 years ago and the researchers didn't live 10,000 years ago, but here's the analogy they use. They say that, you know, say you're one of our ancestors 10,000 years ago is going out into the woods or the tundra, and suddenly he comes across a bear, right? Mm-hmm. Well, if that person is alone, then his brain is going nuts. And he all he can think of is run, 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 run. Okay? He's scared. Everything, you know, fight or flight is going crazy in his brain. Then say he sees someone from a neighboring tribe. Doesn't really know that person, but he sees that person over there. Well, now he only has to outrun the other person, right? So his brain calms down a little bit because the bear will get the other person. But say that ancestor is with his hunting buddy. Suddenly, the brain doesn't see the bear as a threat. The brain sees the bear as dinner.
Right?
Right? And so when you are with friends, you can face the world together, and we are wired to be that way. And that's why friendships are just so important. They're kind of the hidden secret of thriving at midlife and thriving into your later years as well.
Before we head to a break, I want to have you tell this story, which gets us to the idea of when do you let friends go and when do you keep them? And there's this moment when you realized you had to let your mother go. Mm. And this relates to friends as well. And I wondered if you would talk about this.
Yeah.
This moment.
So my mother... She recovered from her stroke. She did very well. Then a few years later, about 3 years ago, she was 92 at the time, 91 at the time. She fell and she shattered her femur, her thigh bone, into a million little pieces. And it was quite an extensive operation. And she came home and suddenly she was isolated. She wasn't able to be independent the way she was before. She spent long hours alone. And she, as often happens, she began to fall a little bit into a depression. And one day, it was shortly after she'd returned home, my brother and I would visit her every single day. But one day I walked in and she was trying to read an article. And when she saw me, her face crumpled. And I said, "Mom, what's wrong?" And she said, I can't even understand the words. I can't even understand this. And then she looked at me and she said, "Sometimes I just wish you and Dave would let me go on." And I said, "You know, let you go on? What do you mean?" And she said, I just don't want to be here. And I said, you mean you want to die, Mom? And she said, yeah. And I said, you know, Mom, you're right. David and I do not want you to go on. But in that moment, what I realized is she needed permission. She had lost control of everything. She was stuck in a chair. She couldn't walk. She couldn't get out. She'd lost control of everything. The one thing she wanted was kind of the decision about how she would live her life, or whether she wanted to live. And she didn't want my brother and me forcing her to live when she didn't want to live. And so I looked at her and I said, Mom, I don't want you to die. But if this is what you want to do, if you feel that your life has been really rich until this point, and that it's not really worth it, if this is a struggle you're having, then I'm with you through that struggle too. I don't want you to die. You know, I don't think it's a choice actually people actually make. But if this is where you are, I am going to be with you. And so she grabbed my hand and she squeezed it. And we talked a little bit more, and then I had to go out of town. But the next day, got her hair kind of all brushed. She had help there. She got herself dressed for the first time in a month. She put on makeup. She put on her little pearls. They went what she calls a taxi or the wheelchair, and they went over to my brother's place, who basically works in the same apartment complex. They both are in the Watergate. So they went to my brother's office, and she went over there and had a fine time talking to my brother. And that was the turning point. What she needed was permission to control the way she lived her life. And we gave her permission to do that, and she's flourishing now. That was 3 years ago.
I realized in that moment, you're right, I have to let her go. What I did not recognize is that I had to let my friends go as well. How does that play into the story?
Oh, that was hard. That's probably the hardest part of the whole book for me. I had a group of friends. It was a Bible study, and we had met every week, basically the same core group, for about almost 20 years, or more than 15 years, I think. And we were very, very close. But what began to happen is when we started, we were all single. And what happened is people got married, people had kids. Two of the women adopted children, one from Kazakhstan. The other was a little girl who was born addicted to heroin, so she needed a lot of care. And you can see that there's this kind of centrifugal force of midlife stuff. We became less and less of a priority and more of an obligation for each other. And while we still really, really loved each other, it just became very hard to keep it going. And I confess, I was the one who put the last straw on the camel's back. I thought they would want to be part of my book on friendship, about how we had shared there and how we had kind of gone through the ups and downs for, oh my gosh, we've been through everything together, just about everything together. And I thought, you know, that they would want to be part of that. And it turned out they didn't. They felt it was way too private. And I understood that. But they felt it was way too private. And the group just broke up after that. It was like it was the last straw. And while we're all individually friends, we actually don't meet anymore. And I think that's kind of one of the tragedies of midlife. And so, you know, not every friendship is forever, or not every group of friendships lasts forever. I've had to find new sets of friends, you know, different Bible study, that kind of thing. And while we are all, you know, they're all coming to my book party and we meet individually, it's just not the same thing. And it's maybe one of the casualties of midlife.
Barbara Bradley Haggerty. Her book is Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Barbara Bradley Haggerty. We're talking about her book, Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. You tell this really interesting story about your brother, Dave. he has this vocal condition, this paralysis, and you also have it, mm-hmm. which it's rare. And you tell about that. This was so interesting. You tell about this prayer that you wrote out. This was from, obviously comes from your Christian Science background. It was like 1999 or 2000, where you prayed that you could take your brother's burden, this vocal condition, from him, and that you would have the voice problem instead. And that's kind of what happened.
Yes. Actually, it was worse than that. We both have it now.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, the irony of that was I was, you know, an NPR correspondent at that time.
Yeah.
But my brother, I have a really, really great brother. He's also quite famous and amazing. He's David Bradley, who owns the Atlantic Magazine and Atlantic Monthly. And so David was an entrepreneur. He owned this magazine. He had a lot of obligations, and he had this terrible voice problem, and he had I may be wrong. I think it was 12 surgeries on his vocal cords. And with each surgery, his voice sounded worse and worse because of the scar tissue. They kept thinking that if we just straighten out the vocal cord a little bit more, the pain will go away. Mm. Well, at this point, I didn't have pain, but I knew, and I didn't have a vocal cord problem, but I knew that David did. And it was ruining his life. There was one year where he couldn't talk for the whole year. He could not talk. And so I prayed this prayer, and, you know, some people will think I'm crazy to even think that this might have an effect. I've found others who believe that there is a real mind-body connection here, that I kind of opened myself up for problems. And the problems did come. They came...
You always think about it working positively. This is a twist.
And, you know, maybe it's just this genetic thing and it had nothing to do, right?
Yeah,
it could
absolutely
be nothing but genes.
Right.
It could be. It's just when I got the pain, I remembered that prayer. And so in 2000, let's see, it was 2009, I lost my voice for about a month, but I didn't have any pain. And what had happened is I got a partially paralyzed vocal cord, which is what my brother had. But, you know, I didn't notice it. I'd lose my voice and then I'd get it back and whatever. And it was a problem because I was a radio correspondent, but it wasn't the end of the world. But then in 2012, I started to get the chronic pain in my vocal cords. And that was when my brother, he would never wish it on anyone, especially his sister, but I think he was a little grateful to have someone to share this with.
Right.
But let me, and he, when I told him about the prayer, he's like, Barb, take that prayer away.
Yeah.
As well, it's a little bit late. Let me tell you, though, Doug, what has happened since. Because I don't like medicine. I've left Christian Science, but I really, really don't like medicine. It makes me stupid. And the nerve medication I was on made me feel really dim-witted. And so I didn't want to be on it. And I was on a lot of it just to get through the day. I mean, literally just to get through the day. And so what I did is I began talking to scientists about the placebo effect and also about brain plasticity. And one particular scientist, Jeffrey Schwartz at UCLA, told me about how when he shows his patients who have OCD, when he shows them that what they've got on a fMRI, on a brain scan, what they've got is a wiring problem. Like, you don't need to wash your hands. You've washed your hands. This is a brain wiring problem. Your brain is just acting weird. When he would show this to them, they could gradually say when they needed to wash their hands, I don't need to. I just wash my hands. This is a brain wiring issue. I started doing that with my voice, with my vocal cord pain, because the paralysis actually didn't last. So this was a faulty brain mechanism going on, telling me that my vocal cord was traumatized and that I had pain. And so when I would feel pain, I'd say, my brother thinks I'm crazy, I'd say, false alarm. This is not reality. This is based, this is a brain wiring issue.
Yeah.
And then I would distract myself, which is really good for pain. They know that. Little by little, I went from having to take 24 pills a day, and they weren't pain medication per se, but 24 pills a day. Now I take 3 at night just for safety's sake. That's how much I've reduced my pain through thinking.
We don't have time to get to some of the things I was hoping to. Let me just make a reference to, you write about love at middle age. and the importance of novelty. Your story, I'll leave to others to read, about going with your husband to live his dream, at least briefly, of taking a trip in an RV, which is a great story. Also, the idea that our minds and our bodies prefer long-term meaning to short-term happiness. We talked a little bit about that. I wanted to talk about, you have this kind of what seems like this epiphany. You'd heard this TED Talk, I think, from Clayton Christensen. People around here know him. He's a Harvard professor. He's the one that really pioneered the idea of disruption. And he said something to you that, or at least this is how it came through to you, this idea of investing time and energy in the things that matter. And you kind of had this realization that at that particular moment anyway, NPR was the only love of your life.
Yeah.
Like you had devoted all of your attention and all of your energy to that. Would you talk about that little moment of epiphany?
And it's a nice place to be in love with. I was just, it's so easy to get the instant gratification of getting a story on the air, getting praise, whatever, day after day after day, that it was very easy for me in my 30s and then in the beginning of my 40s to really focus on that. The other stuff, finding a relationship, finding someone to invest in, finding someone that I had to be sacrificial for, that was harder. And what I realized is that this short-term investment in my career actually had negative long-term outcome. And that the thing that Christensen said is that you have to, things like family and children, these are long-term investments. They don't pay off. They're not a quick shot of dopamine, right? You might not even see the reward for 15, 20 years. And yet it is the thing that matters the most. And what I realized is I really had to, as much as I love NPR, I really, really had to be much more intentional about my marriage, about my relationship with my wonderful stepdaughter, about my family. These were things that truly needed attention. And it makes, because, you know, at the end of the day, at the end of your life, you're not going to roll over in bed and look at, you know, NPR. You're going to roll over and look at the person you've invested a lifetime in, and or call up your stepdaughter or whatever it is. So those are the things that matter, and those are the things I began to invest in a little bit more.
Barbara Bradley Haggerty, her book is Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. This week on NPR, by the way, you can hear stories by Barbara about midlife, and we have links to all of that on our website. She joined us today from the studios of NPR in Washington. Barbara, thank you very much for the time.
It's been so much fun, Doug. Thank you.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.